Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the mega city metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and for this episode, once again, we are headed back to the Metro Toronto Convention Center at this year's Fan Expo Canada 2019, and we are going to walk the hallowed halls of Artist Alley, where I got a chance to speak with some creators and artists. I had an absolute blast this year. It was a very well-balanced and stacked lineup of guests. Kudos to Kevin Boyd for his organization of it. I got to meet some renowned creators such as Steve McNiven, Gail Simone, Mike Grell, and catch up with some local legends and superstars such as Mike Del Mundo, who just wrapped up his run on Thor with Jason Aaron, Michael Walsh, whose Black Hammer Justice League crossover is being released right now, Jason Fabok, who's working on The Three Jokers with Jeff Johns, Ramon Perez, and Marcus Toe from Raid. I got a chance to go to the Raid party on Friday night. Thank you to Shane Heron. Salute, dude. That was awesome. And I have footage, of course, every year of some of the excellent panels that I got to attend, because not all of us can make it to these shows. And depending on how the panels are hosted, you get some pretty great insights on either the creator or the industry. So I plan on sharing those with you. But for this episode, I have a few brief interviews with three new guests who haven't been in the cave yet, and those are Jamal Campbell, who is fresh off of his series with Brian Michael Bendis and David Walker, which was Naomi, and is working on a new project with the Young Animal imprint that he will tell us about during this episode. It was great chatting with him, as well as illustrator Kim Smith, who's been working with Pop Classic Books to adapt classic movies and TV properties such as Back to the Future, E.T., Karate Kid, The X-Files, Buffy, just to name a few, into these kid-friendly, almost bedtime story-like books. They're absolutely gorgeous to look at and a lot of fun, and they really capture the essence of those films and TV shows, so I had to talk to her about it and even pick up a copy of one of her books. Next up, we have Fearless Fred Kennedy, who is radio personality on Q107, has the Issue Zero podcast. It's a great podcast. I highly suggest it. And is also a comic creator, having collaborated with Adam Gorham on Teuton, their creator-owned book, as well as he's also the writer of Fourth Planet, who, if my facts are correct, he has scripted the next issue of Morris from our frequent Cave of Solitude guest, and at this point, part-time co-host, who are we kidding? I mentioned him before, Shane the Sheriff Heron. I'm really looking forward to that book. That book should be ready for March Comic Con. Shane Heron, we talked to him this weekend. He said definitely he's going to be there. He's headed back into the Raid studio, so I can't wait for that collaboration to come together. I'm sure that book is going to be great. And Fred is an awesome dude. He's so much fun to talk to. His panels when he hosts them are a lot of fun. And as far as work ethic goes, this is a guy I really admire. And it's just a matter of time before he makes it big in the industry. That's my guess anyway. So without further ado, I know you didn't listen to this podcast, listen to me ramble on. We're almost 4 minutes in. You can follow us on Facebook. You can email us at caveofsolitude@outlook.com. Follow us on Instagram. And also leave us a review on iTunes. Any type of review helps. We appreciate it. And thank you again for listening to this episode of the Cave of Solitude. So without further ado, we're back on the floor at Artist Alley for Fan Expo 2019 with Jamal Campbell, Kim Smith, and Fearless Fred Kennedy. Okay, we are here now with artist and local Toronto luminary Jamal Campbell. Jamal, thank you for taking some time out of your commission and your day to talk with us.
No, absolutely.
So how's the show been for you so far?
It's been good. It's my first show in a while, actually.
Really?
So I've been sort of refreshed and sort of itching to get back into it.
So what was the cause of the hiatus for you to take a little break?
Really, it was just work. It was really hard sometimes to get sort of to come to shows and leave work behind because you have like deadlines and that you have to meet. So it's just right now I'm starting a new project, so I actually have time to sort of relax. I can come to shows and sort of manage my time better.
It's awesome. It's good to have you back, and it's a good reason to not have to come to a show if you've got to make the comics, right?
Yeah.
So what is it? You just mentioned you're about to start a project now. What is it that you're going to be working on?
Yeah, I'm working on Far Sector, which is a new Green Lantern book out of Young Animal, written by N.K. Jemisin, who's a novelist who writes amazing sci-fi novels. And it's basically a standalone story of this civilization in the far reaches of space, far away from Earth. They had a very tumultuous past, a lot of civil wars, occupation, a lot of sort of infighting, and they decided that the best course forward for their existence would be to take away their emotions. So they subdue their emotions, and they have like hundreds of years of peace. Then out of nowhere, the higher-ups decide that they need a Green Lantern. So they request one, and they request a new Green Lantern, Joe, our protagonist. A new power ring doesn't really work like the other power rings. I'll leave that to the comic to show that. But she comes, sort of patrols the area, and 6 months into her occupation, there's a murder. First murder in 600 years.
While she was supposed to be on the job.
While she is on the job. So the book's really starts off with that and goes into her investigating the murder, sort of going the ins and outs of all the politics and all of the ins and outs of different races of the civilization and everything like that to figure out why does this happen.
Gotcha. That's very intriguing, and it's equally intriguing because it's on Young Animal. Mm-hmm. So does it allow for there to be a little bit more freedom in the creative process as far as, you know, connecting it to continuity or having it be its own thing?
Yeah, absolutely. There are nods to sort of other Green Lanterns and other Green Lantern stuff, but being on Young Animal basically lets us do whatever we want to really tell the story the way we want to tell it, to get weird in some places and not sort of eschew to the typical DC format of storytelling, which is a ton of fun to do.
And how is it going to be an ongoing series, a maxi series? What's the layout for it?
It's a maxi series, so 12 issues.
How do you feel about having your own maxi series that you know will be collected probably forever, right? What's that like for you to have that under your belt now?
It's amazing because not a lot of artists get to have that. And the idea that I'm sort of just starting out at DC, I just finished up Naomi, which was a 6-issue series, which was also like a new character. So be able to create a new character in Naomi, create a new character in Joe now, and have those be two series that are going to be collected as like a graphic novel. It's sort of this unique experience that I'm just sort of like making the most out of.
Pinching yourself?
Yeah.
Tell us about Naomi. What was that about?
Naomi is, again, a new character out of Wonder Comics, which is Brian Michael Bendis's imprint. Sweet. It's written by Bendis and David Walker, drawn by me. And it's about this young girl, Naomi, who's this teenager in a small town in the north Midwest of the U.S. And nothing happens in the town. Super boring. Then one day out of nowhere, Superman and Mongol come crashing in and fighting. And then they zoom out in 7 seconds. Biggest thing ever that's ever happened to the town. Everyone's buzzing about it. And then you hear little whispers about maybe something like this has happened before. Like there's maybe another superhero thing that happened some years later. And there's little whispers about it. And Naomi, being the curious little girl she is, wants to investigate it and find out like what happened, and she finds out that it's somehow connected to her, and so she goes on this journey to sort of like find herself, find her past and everything that's happened in that small town as it pertains to her.
That sounds great. And the reason why I asked about Naomi, because I had heard Brian Michael Bendis talking about this character Naomi, and I wasn't sure if, and he was saying Jamal Campbell's drawing it. I don't know if you've listened to him on other podcasts where he talks about it, and I'm like, is it the Jamal Campbell that I see all the time? Could it be? And I'm, that's great. That's awesome that it was like you were working with him and David Walker. That's a huge notch under your belt. Have you been able to obviously communicate with them? What's it like, the creative process with a titan like Brian Michael Bendis and David Walker? What's it like working with them?
Yeah, it's great because both of them are very open to ideas. So unlike where in a typical sort of partnership, you might have the writer or writers sort of communicate among themselves, then make up a script and then give it to you and then you just draw it. They included me in all of like the story discussions, the brainstorming discussions. So I was there from the beginning, sort of giving my input on how I think the character and the story should be shaped. So it is a very much, it was more of a collaboration than I've ever had with anyone else.
Right.
So it was very open, very freeing. We trust each other a lot, so I give them my ideas. I trust them to make the most and decide what's the best way this fits in their narrative. And then when I get the script, they trust me to take that and sort of elevate it however I can in terms of emotions. If a scene isn't quite working, if I need to insert a panel here and there, they're very open to my input.
That's fantastic, especially with... I'd be intimidated to meet them, but to now, in your case, I mean, you're obviously qualified to work with them, but you've got two people who are both, I think, teachers.
Yeah.
Right? So they know the craft really well, and they've got enough things in their bibliography where it's like, just listen to us, newbie, or, you know, and we'll decide what where it goes. So for them to include you so much, what were some of the things that... Because Naomi's an original character.
Yeah.
So what were some of the things that you got to add your personal touches to in regards to Naomi that we're going to be able to see when we pick up the book?
Right. I think my biggest contribution to Naomi would be sort of her personality and attitude. So when we were first going through it, I did a number of sketches just trying to figure out like the visual look of the character and trying to figure out her facial expressions and emotions, how she would react to things. And through that, that sort of informed how Brian and David wrote her in the book. Sort of how she would react, how her curiosity, how she seeks things out, how she's very, like, she puts up a front of being very sort of solid as a rock, but she's very emotionally vulnerable. And she's open with that to certain people. So it's sort of that, how she reacts to other people, how she interacts with other people, that I had the biggest contribution to.
That's great. So getting back to the Maxi series, it's obviously going to be cosmic. There's going to be a lot of cosmic elements to it. What did you grow up? Did you grow up a comics fan, or just did you have a knack for drawing that eventually brought you into comics? And I'm going to get back to the book. There's a roundabout way of getting back to the book.
Okay. I wasn't a comics fan per se, but I was a superhero fan. So I grew up on the superhero cartoons of the 90s, like Batman the Animated Series, Spider-Man, Iron Man, stuff like that. And that sort of segued as I grew older and could actually spend money on comics into comics itself.
So what were some of the stuff that you grew up reading or even enjoying when you started to create for yourself, or you were part of... Was it Top of the Hat?
From a Hat.
From a Hat, right. When you were part of the artist collaborative there. What were some of the things you liked reading and the things you liked drawing?
Well, the first book that I really got into was Runaways.
Okay.
That was, like, a huge book for me. I really liked, like, Marvel Cosmic, so the Guardians of the Galaxy run with Dan Abnett. The Hawkeye series, obviously, Matt Fraction, and stuff like that. I was very into Marvel. And then on DC side, I was very into Nightwing. That's my favorite character. So I'd, like, read anything he was in.
Right.
And then the way From a Hat, they're basically the reasons I got into comics. So From a Hat was, as a collective, we did a weekly series where we chose a character and we'd all draw that character. And that sort of trained me into getting into different types of characters that I wouldn't have gotten into before, like Hellboy and stuff like that.
Right.
And sort of helped me develop my visual style into what it is now, where I'm pretty much comfortable drawing anything.
Right. And I remember, I don't know if you remember, but you did a Nightwing commission for me in my sketchbook because it was your favorite character. So it's now that you say that you appreciated Guardians of the Galaxy and your scope of what you liked was both street level and cosmic. Is there anything that, as far as getting into the cosmic realm of DC, where you got to kind of draw inspiration, how do you change your style to adapt to that from, you know, being a street level kind of comic fan? Does perspective play much more of a bigger, like, it's much different, right? Having something in space as opposed to having city streets and buildings.
It is and it isn't. Like, I think it comes down to my style is very clean. Yeah. I focus a lot on perspective, on anatomy, and stuff like that. So my style very much more suits the sci-fi angle of it than the gritty street level. So on Far Sector specifically, like, the city Enduring, which is the city that it takes place in, that's very much a character of its own. So I'm very getting into the nitty-gritty of how the buildings look, how the city is structured, how the technology works and all of that. So that very much focuses in on how my focus on when I'm drawing it versus if I'm drawing a street level book, it's the one character and whatever they're doing at the time rather than like their surrounding, because their surrounding is Earth. It's what we're familiar to. Yeah. While on Far Sector, I get to invent the surroundings and the environments and all of that.
So that is that, do you find it more of a challenge or is it more liberating? Because I hear some artists say backgrounds are, you know, the part of the job that I hate, or drawing someone in a car. But in this case, you're in space, or you're on a planet where you can create the flora or whatever it is, how you see it.
Mm-hmm. It's a bit of both. It's the kind of thing is when you're sitting down to go do it, it's very intimidating because you're creating whole cloth out of nothing. Right. And it's up to you to make everything visually impactful and interesting and all that. But for me, once I actually get into drawing it, it's a lot of fun because I can just sort of go stream of consciousness. I'm going to draw this and this and this. And it's going to make it look like this and like make it look like nothing we've seen on this earth and very interesting. So that part is very freeing because there are no rules, basically. I make up the rules.
Right. So even something that could come across or what would in one page be a mistake, in this case, you can turn it into something.
Absolutely.
So does it save you time being able to do that? As opposed to when your storytelling is, I gotta reference the Empire State Building, and if people will know if it's not right.
It doesn't save me time. It definitely saves me like peace of mind, because again, there's no reference for anything, so I can I can't make any mistakes in how I draw this building or how I draw this animal that doesn't exist. Right.
Right. Right. That's great. So where do you go for inspiration when it comes to, I mean, you like you said, you're developing something from whole cloth, but there are, I guess we have a visual library of sci-fi, kind of what we lean towards. What are some of the things for you?
For me, I'm a cyberpunk kind of guy. So Netrunner, Blade Runner, things like Ghost in the Shell, Alita Battle Angel, like all of that is sort of what I grew up on, like anime-wise and cyberpunk-wise. So I'm taking very much those visuals of the dark, oppressive, misty, rainy city with neon lights and flying cars and upside-down buildings that float in the air and stuff like that, and sort of finding ways to twist that with, like, you have this steel building next to this building that's made of plants and trees that's glowing pink and with vines coming out that people glide on and stuff like that.
So as far as an artist-to-artist person, you're still a fan to some extent. Who are some of the artists whose work inspire you or you still enjoy? Do you still enjoy reading comics now that you're making them as a job? Do you start to hate the job or do you still love them?
I still love them. I don't get to read them as much as I used to just because the job is so time consuming. But one of my favorite artists is Joshua Milton. He doesn't do interiors that often anymore, but he does amazing covers. He did a run of Batgirl and Aquaman covers, variant covers, which are amazing. Jorge Jimenez is a powerhouse right now on Super Sons and Justice League, and whenever I see his work, it's just, oh, you can do that? You can make stuff look like that, so dynamic and so clean as well.
You kind of have a little bit of that Jorge Jimenez style to you. I can see you're not a facsimile at all, but there's that sort of, I forgot how you described it before, but it's your work breathes. It's very clean.
Yeah.
So when it comes to picking up any of the books that you've done in the past, I know you did some cover work for Power Rangers, you've got Naomi. What are some other things that people can look forward to either picking up now or that are going to be coming out, such as the next project you have coming?
Yeah, I did a Prowler run for Marvel a little while ago. That was my first actual comic book interior run, which I'm super proud of. And then I actually did I helped out on a couple issues of Nightwing, which was like a tease because I want to do more.
But so keep saying the things that you like because they're all coming together.
No, absolutely. Every couple of months, I just say to my editors, Nightwing, Zatanna, hey. But yeah, Nightwing was good, Green Arrow, and then Naomi just finished up. The trade is coming out in October. Then, of course, Far Sector coming out in November.
That's fantastic. It's really good to see one of the local guys who, you know, every year you guys are always building up the portfolio, the things you guys are working on are getting bigger and bigger. And man, you did a series with Brian Michael Bendis and David Walker, man. That's awesome. Congratulations. All the best on the next upcoming projects. And hopefully you won't be too busy that you won't be able to come to the shows.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Awesome. Okay, this is day two at Fan Expo Canada 2019, and right now we have the privilege of being able to speak with illustrator and artist Kim Smith. Kim, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
I was walking by Artist Alley yesterday, and my attention was immediately drawn to your table because I'm a huge fan of Back to the Future and E.T. and Karate Kid, and I was, you know, you get a lot of people here who have these sort of pastiche pieces of fan art, but this was official product, so I was immediately drawn to your table. Can you tell us what it is that you have here that you're displaying or selling this weekend at Fan Expo?
Well, at Fan Expo this weekend, I have the Pop Classic series, which is a collection of picture books based off of popular movies and TV shows. So I have Karate Kid, E.T., The X-Files, Earth Children Are Weird, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and Back to the Future. But I also have a little bit of my personal work, some fun pins, and they're animals and sweaters, and as well as some prints of mine kind of inspired by Calgary and kind of the Rocky Mountains, which is where I live.
Oh, so you're okay. You're from Canada as well. Good. Is this your first time at Fan Expo?
Yes, this is my first time at Fan Expo, and actually only my second time to Toronto, so it's a bit of an adventure.
Are you enjoying it so far?
Yeah, it's great.
How have people reacted to the books? I'm walking around and I see people with these books inside of like their strollers. Already the kids are reading them. How overall do you have? But you'd have a better take on what the response has been.
Actually really fun to see how excited parents get about the books, because it's kind of a fun way to share a lot of their favorite like movies and TV shows with their kids, kind of before the kids are maybe old enough to watch something like Buffy or The X-Files, and kind of get them into it ahead of time, you know?
Right. Were any of these movies things that you grew up watching? You don't look old enough to have been born in the 80s to have watched these movies, but did you?
I'm born in 86, so...
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm 84. You look very young.
Right on. Yeah, I get that all the time. But, I mean, Buffy, out of all the books, kind of, like, Buffy was something that I really loved, kind of in my early teenage years. So that was something I like, watched from week to week, and it was something I loved. Back to the Future, I remember my dad shared that set of movies with us, and me and my sisters when we were really young. So it was like such a treat to get to illustrate those two books especially.
For sure. So how did you come together with Pop Classics books to be the illustrator for these pop culture classics?
So it all started with Home Alone. That was the first book that we did in the series. And the publisher, Quirk Books, they're out of Philadelphia. They just kind of approached me and asked me if I wanted to work on Home Alone. And, of course, I grew up with Home Alone. So I said, yes, I would love to illustrate that book. And it was really well received. People loved it. So we just decided to continue the series from there.
That's great. So what's the process like when you take these staples of movies that most people either watch on repeat or know them really, really well? How do you adapt it into a story so that a young person would be able to consume it and understand it, but staying true to all of the highlighted parts of the movie that like stay in our mind when we think about them?
So I'm actually kind of lucky. I don't have to distill the movies or TV shows down. We work with a writer, and they kind of figure out all the stories. So by the time it comes to me, I just kind of have to figure out, like, what's the most fun way to show this in a picture. So I try and include a lot of the fun details from the movies. Like, I sit and watch the film all the way through and take little photos of it to make sure that it's really true to the original material. And just to make sure fans really enjoy it, right? So, yeah, I already, once I get the story, I just start drawing the pictures, and it kind of goes.
I'm pretty envious of your job to have to watch the movie and pick the moments that you feel like drawing. One, I can't draw, but to be able to watch a movie for work and then translate it, that's pretty awesome. Have any of them been particularly more of a challenge than another one, or were there any, like you said, Buffy, because Buffy meant so much to you, did you spend a little more time, or was it easier because you loved it so much?
You know, each book kind of has its own challenges. I'm trying to think if there's... Oh, well, one book in particular that was a little bit challenging was actually E.T., designing E.T., just the character, and making sure he had that cuteness, because I always heard from adults that there were... Some of them were afraid of him as children, so just making sure that it was cute and, yeah, accessible to young audiences, that was just one of those particular challenges. But
is there anything that they... I guess to update things or to make the book have more of a wider audience, I guess, that's represented. Is there anything that ever is changed in the books in order to make the people that you see in it more like 2019?
Well, I try and keep kind of like the background characters and things like that more diverse. And trying to think if there's anything else. They're pretty much true to the source. It's kind of... challenge to like figure out how to keep them kind of like true to the original material and like kind of bring them into now. Yeah.
And people can be pretty precious with this stuff too, right? Like why does that change? That person doesn't look the way they should, or why is that kid in the gang different? So I get you. Is there one that you find that people have more of a like their attention is immediately goes to it? Is there a favorite amongst the fans?
You know, it kind of just depends on what you're a fan of. Everybody goes to a different sort of book.
You were saying Home Alone was the first.
Yeah.
That's a perfect book for this style of storytelling. But you don't have it here. How come?
It's the middle of summer, and I'm coming all the way from Calgary, so it can be a little bit of a challenge to bring them all with me. So I just didn't take the bet that Home Alone would do.
You didn't think it would be the Christmas spirit would be happening just yet. You know what's funny? It was on TV on Wednesday or Thursday night. Home Alone was actually playing on TV back-to-back in the dead of summer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it's funny that you mentioned that you did want to bring it for that particular reason. Is there anything coming up next? Oh, I think somebody wants to. So is there what's next on the list for some books that you might be working on, if you can tell us?
For sure. Well, what's really exciting that in a week and a half, my own book is coming out.
Okay.
It's called Box Text. It's about kids who make extraordinary things out of ordinary things, in this case, boxes. And then after that, I'm trying to think what books, on September, I can't remember, I think it's on the 10th. I've worked with the Property Brothers on their kids' book. So Builder Brothers is a series. So Builder Brothers Big Plans is out, I believe, September 10th. And then October 1st, Home Alone 2 comes out.
So, oh, awesome.
Yeah.
That's great. Is there a project that is on like your wish list that you would want to adapt if you could? If they said, okay, Kim, anything, you know, you have any recommendations? Obviously, there's some licensing issues, but do you have a wish list of stuff that you'd like to work on?
Yeah, Jurassic Park would be like my dream movie to adapt. I think it would be so much fun. It's a movie that I loved growing up. It's probably my favorite movie of all time.
Yeah, it's a great one.
Yeah.
You can always go back to that, and when it's on TV, it's like, yeah, we're going to watch this.
Yeah.
One last question before we wrap up. What's been the best part of this experience in regards to making these stories that now kids can enjoy, or just the fulfillment you get out of being an illustrator for children?
I think the most fulfilling thing is just hearing about parents sharing the books with their kids, and either the enjoyment that they have with like story time at that time, just reading the stories with their kids, and yeah, how much it brings them together. Like, it's really sweet to get an email or hear someone at the show and saying that they've picked up the books and they just love it, and their kids love it too.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I mean, all of these movies and adaptations you have here, they're pivotal movies. Like, I grew up literally on Back to the Future. It raised me. I must have watched it, by the time I was four, I would say upwards of 50 times. Like, I had it memorized.
Wow.
So, it honestly, like Karate Kid, there's things that they change you when you watch some of these movies. So, for a young person, because nowadays people are kind of like, I think they're too young to watch it. The content's a little bit too intense for them. But this is a great distilled way for them to get that story and all of the good parts of it and to share it at story time. So that's great. I love it. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Well, thanks so much for talking with me.
I hope you have a great, successful weekend and a safe travel home.
Thanks.
All right, we are day three at Fan Expo Canada 2019, and now we have the privilege to be talking with the busiest man in show business here today. You know him from Q107 if you listen. It's Mr. Fred Kennedy, Fearless Fred Kennedy. Welcome to the Cave of Solitude.
I'm glad to be here, feeling solitude-y. It's going to be good. Yeah.
How's your weekend going so far?
Pretty solid, actually. Really steady sales. It's good. And just seeing everybody that you've come up with and whatnot and talk to them about projects they're working on. That's like the coolest part is those little tidbits. What's his face? The artist for Black Sad, which is like one of my favorite comics ever. We were at his table and he's got like the new Black Sad book and then he does a little sketch in it and I'm fanboying out. I got like super like fanboy about it and I don't really do that. I try not to anyways. But, like, Black Sad's so good. And then he's like, shows me his book that comes out on Wednesday and it's in French and half of it doesn't have any dialogue and I was like losing my mind. It's really good, by the way, but that's like the best part about coming to shows, that stuff, really.
And you're you know, a pro, but you're also like a man of the people. We see like your love for this stuff and you're like so approachable and what are some of the things, like, as a fan that you grew up that attracted you to comics?
Escape, really. It was the escape, the fantasy of it. Everyone wants to have superpowers. I used to always want to be Iceman.
Why Iceman?
Yeah, just Iceman. I don't know why Iceman. I loved Iceman growing up because he'd turn to ice, lasers would like reflect off of him and stuff. He was rad. I loved Iceman. And then You tell your own stories. We started playing, like, role-playing games. That was how we really got into, like, superheroes and stuff. It's mostly through that because I would buy comics when I could, but I'd never really had money to buy comics often. So buying role-playing games like the Palladium Heroes Unlimited, you can, like, make your own comics in your head with all your friends and have these big adventures. And we would, like, scout out locations around the city, and then we would imagine that's where the game took place. So then you'd walk around, take a tour of that area, and then go back home and roll dice, and you could visualize your superhero there doing stuff. So that's what we really did. And I think, like, that's where the beginning of, like, storytelling came from, because I never really wanted to write per se. I just wanted to, like, tell stories and think of stories. Writing them down was hard. Role playing is like you're all talking and having fun.
It seems like a lot of people who are into writing this type of stuff always, like you just said, they started with the role-playing. Because I didn't play role-playing games and I love to write, but I can't come up with like a story of my life. I always think, like, I'd love to be able to be a writer, but all these guys seem to be so imaginative and creative, and it seems like the role-playing games was that linchpin.
Yeah, well, it's like a collaborative process. So your dungeon master, game master. I say dungeon master because, like, for some reason everyone's playing Dungeons and Dragons right now.
Yeah.
I just hope that trickles into the other role-playing games like Palladium, who I still say have a way better combat system and skill system, but we don't need to talk about that. It's just the DM or GM creates the setting, and then the players all create part of the story. So it's like you're contributing to a story without even realizing you're doing it. And it's storytelling, but it's not heavy lifting, you know what I mean?
Right.
So it's a fun process, yeah. Everyone, I think a lot of people that are creators have dabbled in some role-playing games at one point, even if it's just a video game, you know?
Right. So when did that, for you, translate into writing, wanting to write comics? Or was that always kind of there? When did you get the courage to just, let me do it?
It was in Edmonton in the late 90s, like a 24-hour comic book challenge. But I never really wrote anything aside from just like those 24-hour, 12-hour comic book challenges. And I wasn't really even writing the story to write the story. I was going to hang out with other people that were like comic people that hung out at the same store that I did. That was really the motivation for going to those things. I didn't care. And then it wasn't until like I met Gorham like in like 2009. And he was like writing Vampire Conspiracy and made it like the way he talked about it, he was you know, you can just create comics. I was like, oh, that's crazy. So that was it.
And you guys did a project together. It's 3-volume. Tell the people about it.
That was called Teuton. It's like historical fantasy. It was pretty rad. A lot of things about it I'd change if I could do it again now.
But
that was cool.
Well, you're supposed to feel that way, right? Because it shows growth. But we don't, the people who read it don't know that.
Oh, yeah, you do. Totally do.
Don't spoil it.
No, I'm not going to spoil anything. But yeah, it's like you learn, you grow, you do all that stuff. I've got, the frustrating thing now is you have stories and you have to create a story to tell a pitch. But just because you've told that whole story and you do that pitch, that doesn't mean the story's going to come out. So sometimes it feels like you've written so many things, but no one will ever see them, you know? So it's like if you go through my laptop, you'd see like my Microsoft Surface laptop, by the way. They pay me every time I say that. You'll see so many stories that have been written, but you've never seen anywhere. And that can be depressing. It's like looking at a graveyard sometimes, you know? Not even graveyard. It's looking like a fucking room full of jars full of stillborn babies is what it is.
Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah. It's a good analogy, you know?
I guess, but in this case,
there are all these little stories in jars that are just left there, you know?
But they can still become something.
Yeah.
They're not going to stay stillborn. Like, for instance, Jim Zub was talking about Stone Star.
Yeah.
It was an idea he had from years ago, and he pulled it back out. So yeah. You never know, some of those stories on that Microsoft, they're going to see the light of day one day.
Yeah.
You got to be positive.
Oh, yeah. I don't mean that to sound negative. If anything, that's like it's motivation to be like, I did it before, I can do it again. Like, how many stories can you tell? Like, you look at these guys that have these catalogs of incredible stories that they've written. Like, Jim Zub is one of those guys. And you just think, how many things did you write that we've never seen?
Right.
And so it's like an iceberg. Like, when you're writing a story, it's like an iceberg. Because to have understanding of these characters and who they are and where they're going and what they're doing, you need to know their life, their backstory, what they like to do. And my voice just cracked. And you have, like, so much stuff about those characters that the reader will never see. They can just infer. But it's those things they don't see that give the character depth and, like, a system of morality that they follow and obey in the comic or the story that you're telling. And then you think about, like, that goes a step further with, like, all the stories that you're actually seeing are just the top of the ones that crested out of the water, and the rest of them are all below that, you know? So sometimes I'd like to go through, like, Hickman's laptop and see what he's got on there. Probably some good stories in there.
A lot of graphic design, for sure.
Yeah.
Are you reading the X-Men, his new X-Men stuff?
I'm waiting for the trade. I'm that guy. I'm a horrible man.
I'm that guy, too.
Yeah, I get the trades because my kids destroy floppies,
right.
So I get the trades, and it's easier for me to keep them on a bookshelf, and they leave them alone. So, yeah, I've been hearing nothing but great things, but I don't want to hear any more about it because I want to read it for myself. That's not me going like, dude, you're not allowed to talk about it on social media. Like, I got friends that, like, forward me things when they know I'm waiting, and it's like, that's lame.
Right.
Yeah.
So, speaking of story, what's a story growing up that always resonated with you when you read it? It's the one that sticks in your head and you always go back to it.
Oh, a story?
Or a storyline, like a comic line, like that was your jam.
Well, like, the Infinity Gauntlet was always my jam growing up. Like, that's that is, without a doubt, where it all began for me, period. But that wouldn't be the story that it would be. Like, if I'm being, like, honest, it's Star Wars. Like, 100% it's Star Wars. There's not even a close second. It's Star Wars by a mile. by a wide mile.
Is it because of the age of when it was introduced to you? Because I have this conversation with people sometimes. Has the Marvel Universe surpassed what Star Wars once was? Like Thanos as a villain as opposed to Darth Vader?
No.
Not for you.
Depends who you talk to, but like, there's no right or wrong answer. Like, no, I get really annoyed when people are like, your opinion about a thing you like is wrong. It's like, so?
Yeah.
It's like, people can like what they like. Like, that's the thing about fandom, is like what you like, man. Don't let anyone tell you what you have to like. I get very upset when people think something has to be for everyone. Like, everyone has to like this, or you're wrong. It's no.
That's what makes it beautiful. It's art, right?
Yeah, man.
We all react differently.
So, like, for me, it's Star Wars. And it's just like Darth Vader is the best. And seeing that scene in Rogue One where he just goes full Vader.
Yeah, to me,
that was like, remember we're talking about you're telling stories in your head, role playing? That's what I always saw Vader doing growing up. Like that right there. Like going down that hallway and just walk. Like that's what I always envisioned when I was growing up. And then to see it is like, I think that is what I love Rogue One so much. Like,
it's just a great movie.
It's I would put it on par with Empire, and people can like what they like. I know that some people think that The Last Jedi is the be-all end-all, and some people think it's the worst, and I don't think either one of those people are wrong for having those opinions.
Right.
But for me, it's Rogue One, and if you don't like it, well, fuck off. Like, I really like that movie.
It's a good movie.
Yeah.
I liked it better than Solo. Solo I maybe could have done without, but Rogue One I thought was essential. Solo was better the second viewing.
Yeah, it was fine. You know, it's cool.
It's cool that it
like, exists. The thing is like, there's room for all those stories, and I don't understand why everyone has to think that everybody who's a Star Wars fan has to like everything about Star Wars. It's like, no, you don't.
There's
like,
so much of it.
Yeah, like, my kids think Phantom Menace is awesome. I don't, but I think that lightsaber battle with Obi-Wan, Qui-Gon, and Darth Maul is amazing.
Right?
Yeah. But that doesn't mean that, you know what I'm getting at. Yeah.
Well, I know you got to go. You got some panels to attend to, so I appreciate your time. Next time we record, I want to talk to you about Conan. And I want to talk to you about Silver Surfer.
Why are you bringing that up now? Why are you bringing up Conan when I gotta go?
Because
you're
then
hooking
it.
Me.
Yeah, next I'm hooking. Hooking. That's right. See, that's a good interview skills that you're teaching me. So next time I'm new to Conan. I'm getting into it. So I want you to give me your top five favorite Conan stories. Maybe next time.
Oh, I can do that right now.
Yeah.
I can do that right now.
Okay.
All right. I'm gonna give you my top five, and this isn't me going, these are the best. These are just the ones that,
speak to you.
When I think Conan, these are the things that I think about. There is and there's Red Nails, the original like 1970s black and white version. I forget who did the inks on that one, but it's really great. The way it opens with Valeria, and it's got like this very like, when they fight the giant dragon, it's not even so much a dragon, like they're fighting a dinosaur, which has a Stone Age vibe to it. So that's sort of one of the things that I always think about with Conan. In terms of the stories, the very first Conan story I ever read was People of the Black Circle, which is one of the original weird magazine stories, whatever, back when it was published in magazines in like the 1920s and 30s. Then, after that, it would have to be The Hour of the Dragon, which is my all-time favorite Conan story, period, end of story. It's the only like full-on Conan novel that exists, and it was published after Howard died. Then there is Volume 8 of the early 2000s run from Dark Horse. Tim Truman, I think, did the writing, and I forget the name of the guy who did the art, but it's absolutely gorgeous. And it's the Black Colossus.
Giarello? Not no.
Giarello. I think it's Giarello. It's the Black Colossus. It's a standalone graphic novel with Conan, start to finish. It's such a Conan story. It hits all the buttons. And then it's involving Bellet, and it's with James Herron drawing it. And I don't even remember the story because I was chewing through so much. But it's right around when Conan is with Bellet, and he's taken prisoner, and he's waiting for Bellet to rescue him, and he's fighting like a gladiatorial pit. And James Herron draws this decapitation scene, and it is like one of the greatest panels you will ever see in a comic book, period. The way the head is expressed and twists and is like shooting off of the panels towards the eyes. That's it. It's my Conan top five, man.
It's a good top five.
Actually, an honorable mention to the movie, the original movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger is awesome. I don't care. It's an awesome movie. It's DAF, as the kids would say. It's just, it's great. The music, the vibe. Arnold Schwarzenegger is not Conan. He's a bodybuilder, and Conan's supposed to be like a boxer, one of the Galatas, like not Galatas, one of the Klitschko brothers would be like the perfect Conan body. But he sells you on it. He's got the mirth. He's like, Krom, give me strength. And if you don't listen, to hell with you. It's like all the things that you want Conan to do. And it's just, it's dope. Like, he dies, he comes back to life. It's just, it's awesome. Like, it's an awesome movie, but it's just needs more. Yeah, it's great. I love that movie. I don't care what anyone says. Conan's an awesome movie.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, you have a good rest of the weekend, and hopefully we can get you back on the podcast. We'll talk about 100 Bullets.
Yes.
And Silver Surfer.
Absolutely.
All right, bro. Thank you.
See ya.
That's what's important. Balrog pleases you, Krom. So grant me one request. Grant me revenge. And if you do not listen, then the hell with you.